This is an Equity Bates Media podcast.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Equity Minds.
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is useful.
Equity.
Welcome to another episode of Equity Mates, a podcast where we help you learn to invest in 45 minutes or less. We break down the world of investing from beginning to dividend so that you can hopefully make some returns. My name is Bryce, and as always, I'm joined by my equity buddy, Ren. How's it going, bro?
I'm very good, Bryce. Looking forward to this episode a lot. We've just gone through ASX reporting season, and we've got an expert here to help us make sense of it all. And then towards the back end of the interview, we're going to talk about finding truly great long-term businesses, the true goal of this podcast and, you know, the community. So I think I'm going to get a lot out of this conversation.
Likewise, it is our pleasure to welcome Rudy Filipek van Dyk to the show. Welcome, Rudy.
Well, all of a sudden, I'm interested too. Thanks for having me, guys.
No, thanks for coming on.
So Rudy is the editor and founder of FN Arena, founded back in 2002. And if you recall the episodes we did on reporting season, all of the data and info that we used in that, we got from FN Arena. So that offer is still available if you would like to test Rudy's full service for 4 weeks for free. Just mention Equity Mates when you sign up in the box. Anyway, back to Rudy. He successfully built up an online financial services in the Netherlands and has now focused his attention back on FN Arena, which is a website that provides research on Australian equities, and we're very excited to dig into his great mind and understand a lot more about it. So, Rudy, as I said, welcome to the show.
I hope I brought my mind along.
I'm sure you have.
So, Rudy, before we get into all of that, we do like to start these interviews with a bit of a game where we throw out a topic or an index or something, and we get your thoughts on whether it's overrated or underrated.
Okay, I'll let you know now. I'm terrible at timing.
That's all right. So's Bryce.
Underrated. Oh, sorry. I'll wait.
So, We'll kick off. We've just got a few today, but we'll start with index investing. Overrated or underrated?
Underrated.
And why is that?
Most investors will find it very, very difficult to continuously outperform the index on a consistent basis. That in particular applies to professional fund managers. I hope we're all aware. We're all aware about that. That nobody talks about it, but we are aware of that famous bet that Warren Buffett took on with a fund manager, basically, with a hedge fund. And said, like, you might be able to beat the index, but not after fees.
Mm.
And he won that bet.
Yeah.
I mean, and that basically goes for the whole industry, basically. Mm. So the big message to everyone who has had a good year this year is that enjoy it while it lasts. I mean, the share market is sometimes very accommodative, and it can be very unaccommodative at other times. And that's just how it works. I mean, the share market basically is this beast that allows us to do whatever we do, and other times it won't allow anything.
So enjoy it while it lasts. A bit of an ominous tone to start this interview.
Overrated or underrated, the Australian residential property market?
Oh, that's a good one. Probably overrated, but Australia has a very particular environment, a very particular set of dynamics. And that has, in particular over the past two decades or so, has served everyone quite well in property. But I think the whole property thing is very much overhyped, and the industry itself wants to overhype it, of course. And I mean, in this particular period, like one of the things that's all, I mean, they do not report a lot of data which doesn't serve the cause, right? Mm. And if you lend your ear to the right type of expert in the market, you know there's a lot of people who actually don't make money out of property, right? If you have to take into account the money you spend on upgrading your house, the inflation that you take into account as well, and the fact that maybe you spend a lot of hours on doing it yourself, then often you're kidding yourself, yeah, as an investment. But anyway, I mean, we are very good at kidding ourselves, we humans, you know what I mean? And I think property is one of those ways in which you can see that. But globally, there are plenty of times, plenty of markets where people actually lose money. You know what I mean? I remember about 15 years ago, I read a study about the Swiss property market, and that hadn't moved for 2 decades.
Wow!
At that time, so people were not that keen in putting their money in property there, unless they wanted to live in one. But as an investment, was absolutely not interested because it didn't move. Mm. Right? If it doesn't move for 2 decades, nobody's interested.
Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. The last one, now this is an asset class that definitely has been moving over the last few years. Overrated or underrated, Bitcoin?
Overrated.
And why is that?
I think people misunderstand what Bitcoin will stand and misunderstand what will happen in the future. Everyone who buys it as a anti-system asset is going to be surprised by what happens when the system actually fights back. And you will see now that central banks globally at some point will introduce their own e-currencies, let's call them like that. And that basically will mean that there will be no place for Bitcoin. And there's two reasons for that. One is, of course, when central bankers launch like an e-euro, e-Australian dollar, etc., those will be official, and those will be the ones that everyone uses, basically, from business to governments to taxpayers, you name it. So who's going to use Bitcoin then? The other element, of course, is that central bankers who are working on those e-currencies are very much focused on the stability of those currencies, which is the reason why they will probably be launched locally, domestically first, and then test them out for a while, find ways to keep them stable, and then connect them internationally. The big question mark, which I always had for Bitcoin, is how can an asset, and they call it a currency, but it's actually an asset, that goes from 0 to 20,000, back to 4,000, back to 10,000, back to 6,000, back to 12,000, how can that be used as a stable means of exchange of anything other than speculation? And that will be the downfall of Bitcoin.
Well, I'm long Bitcoin, so.
do you want to have the argument? Or?
No. It's purely a hedge. It's a hedge.
Yeah.
Not a lot long, that's for sure. So, Rudy, before we get into, as Alex said, COVID reporting season and then unpacking the search for long-term successful businesses, we always love to get the story of our guest's first investment. So how about we start there? Are you able to share the story of your first investment and perhaps any major lessons that you've learned from it that are still carried through to today?
I think this is going to be my first surprise of the day, I think. Everyone who pays attention to the detail will notice I'm missing a piece of my finger.
Yeah, I did notice that.
And that's basically the story of my first investment. I lost my finger in an accident. I was 9 years old. First lesson learned, insurance companies don't want to pay out. And so I ultimately got a very small payout, and that was money I could only access after I became 21, and I was 9 at the time. So my first investment went into some kind of a banking product, which gave me, at the time, 15% interest.
Wow. Jeez, wow. Must be nice.
Unheard of.
Which even me being 10 years old or so, 11 years old, obviously, or whatever, I thought that was quite a cool interest. But obviously, it took me many, many, many more years to realize that was actually not a good thing. But it gives you an insight about this is the 80s, right? How high inflation was, how high bond yields were, and how high the interest was that if you put your money in the bank. Mm. And obviously, times have changed dramatically. And those were not good times for the share market, by the way. In that environment, shares don't really thrive.
Yeah, well, who would put your money in shares when you can get 15% in the bank?
But you have to realize that, I mean, if you get 15% in the bank, it probably means that inflation is 13 or 14% as well. So you're not actually on net base, you're actually not making money. It's just another one, the way we delude ourselves.
Yeah. So from there to now, you've obviously had a long career, you know, studying financial markets and companies and all of that. Have you developed a personal investing philosophy?
I think so, yes. By the way, thanks for giving away my age. Or at least a suggestion.
If people can do maths, you said 9 years old in the 80s. So
I lied. That was in the 70s. See, I was only lying about my age. The philosophy, yes. I've actually learned by doing this that quality is in the end what gets you through times. Through tough times and through good times. I'm certain we'll talk about it a little bit more in later topics. But it's also one of the things I think is very difficult for investors, because if you listen to the commentary and you read things about investing in share market, everyone has a different definition about quality. I mean, it's one of those words that's just being used.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everyone has quality. Right?
Yeah.
By default, nothing becomes quality.
Yeah.
Mm. So that's difficulty number one. And difficulty number two is that everyone is always... interested in or very much focused on what's happening in the immediate, what is happening now. And then the eternal question comes, Rudy, if it's such a good stock, how come the share price is falling? Mm. Right? And that's always the eternal question. You go like, well, and then you start talking about it. Not everything is intelligent that happens in the share market and all of that. And then people look at you and they go like, what's he talking about? And I go, I'm still talking about the share market, but yes. So that's the difficulty. And my analysis, my research has led me to re-emphasizing and actually really, really focus on quality. And I'm trying to get that message across to investors as well.
So we'll hold off on asking what your definition of quality is until yes. We get to that part of the conversation. So if people want to know, they're going to have to keep listening.
Well, maybe I should tell people what is not quality.
Sure, right? Sure.
See, a Telstra share price that peaked in 1999 and today is about 70% lower. See, wow. That's not quality.
Yeah. Yeah? Yeah.
An AMP share price that peaked, I think from memory, in 1999 or 2000 as well, at around $21, $22. Today it's $1 something. See, that's not quality.
Yeah.
So it's easy to point out what isn't. Right? And people are always surprised. They go, how do you know? Well, you just look at the long term. Right? A good company appreciates in time. It doesn't fall by 70%.
So before we do dig in further, let's just take a step back and chat about FN Arena, because some of the stuff you're doing there is awesome. But I think I'm particularly interested in the why behind FN Arena. It sort of really aligns with what we're trying to do at Equity Mates. And, you know, we were discussing off air about the innovative process that you're going through and that sort of stuff. So why did you start FN Arena, and sort of what is your philosophy and what does it offer?
First of all, there's a personal reason. I built a new service in the Netherlands, but I'm actually born in Belgium. So I migrated to the Netherlands, published my own newspapers. Then I started chasing criminals.
You have to do something. As you do.
As a journalist? Or?
Yeah, as a journalist.
Okay. As a side hustle. Yeah. Right?
Really
as the crime catcher.
So, private investigator over here.
Maybe make the world better. Start with some action. Yeah? And I ultimately was lucky enough that at the very early stages of... This might be very difficult for you guys to comprehend, but... In the mid-90s, the internet was pretty much very new and hidden for most large parts of the population, right? And I saw the potential. I was interested. I got the opportunity to build a new service, the first one in the Netherlands on the internet. And that obviously I thought it's a great chance to do it. And after 5 years, I'd build it out until the number three player in the country. And then I decided we're going to do something else. So I moved to Australia.
You didn't want to go for number one.
And I thought I've done my dough. Right? And the irony was that in Australia, the recession, it sort of was a recession. Officially, it wasn't, but in practice, it was. After the NASDAQ meltdown, nothing much happened here for a while. And in that period, I found myself here as an experienced finance journalist, and nobody was waiting for me. So I had a few, let's call them corporate accidents with people trying to do stuff, and it didn't really work out. And then I decided, you know what, I'm not going to wait for it anymore. I'm just going to do something myself. So I started FN Arena at that point in time. And there's a little bit of a Robin Hood feel to it. When I was in the Netherlands, when I did the news service, one of the things I picked up in those days, the big American firms were coming to Europe and issuing research on European stocks. Every time the guys like Merrill Lynch or whatever opened research or upgraded, downgraded, had a big impact on stock prices. I mean, could be up 7% on a day or whatever. Coming to Australia, I noticed all these stockbrokers here were exchanging research amongst themselves and keeping it to themselves and for their customers. So I thought, like, oh, that's a bit, let's make that transparent. Mm-hmm. So I made sure I had my finger in the merry-go-round loop, and I started doing the Australian Broker Call, which basically gave investors an insight in what those stockbrokers were telling their customers. And that then ultimately became a whole website, a whole service, and we just built that out. Then the GFC came along, and upon that point, we were simply communicating what the experts were saying and all of that. But then the GFC came along, and all those experts, they were staring like a deer in the light, not knowing what to do. And I thought, I have no business anymore. I had to basically jump into the limelight and starting to tell investors what they should do. First thing, sell your banks, right? And I was one of the first and one of the only one, one of the few in Australia who actually said, sell your banks. Yeah? Everyone said, like, everyone else says it's okay. I go like, no, it's not going to be okay. And I sort of, man, sell the banks was the first big call. The other one was sell energy stocks when oil went to $130 in May or June 2008. Again, one of the very few who saw what was coming. See, those are those points where you realize that up until that point, if you read enough, you know that stuff. Up until that point, every time the oil price doubles in a very short time span, you get an economic recession because economies can't cope with that. Yeah? Yet in 2008, it happened, and absolutely nobody was talking about the recession. And I thought, like, who's crazy here? Is it me or is it the market? Right? And it turns out it was the market, because we did get a recession, right? It's just that when oil prices kept on going up, nobody was talking about a recession, right? So I made a little bit of a name in 2008 with making those calls, and luckily they got some coverage in the likes of the Australian and stuff like that. I used the GFC to dig deeper into research, and my research then led me to the conclusion that not all stocks are equal. And some stocks in the GFC did not drop by 50, 60, 70%. Mm-hmm. And a lot of other stocks did well. And so I tried to figure out, like, what is the difference? Why does one stock drop by 80% or the business go out of business or whatever? And the other ones are just, I mean, pretending like nothing happened. And from that came the concept I developed, which I call all-weather stocks. And we'll talk about it later. But that's basically my first realization that not all stocks are equal, and some stocks are a lot better than other stocks, and there's a lot more quality there than those stocks you can trust, essentially. Mm. And from that onwards, I guess one of the things that has happened since is that while a lot of investors were very skeptical when I started writing in that way, because they go, yeah, right, I mean, not all stocks are equal. Let me tell me something new. But I guess a decade later, many, many investors have now caught up with the fact that I was right. My research has some validity to it. I'm very proud of the fact that a lot of investors now have portfolios, or half of their portfolios, or part of their portfolios, with stocks that they would otherwise not even looked at.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, I get on a regular basis, I get messages or emails, and they say, like, I mean, without you, Rudy, I would have never thought about these stocks. And now they go, like, and you've changed my whole view on the share market.
So this is probably a good point to remind people that if they want a month free of FN Arena, go to fnarena.com and make sure you say that Equity Mate sent you, and you'll get a month free.
That's true. I have to do it manually though, but if you say Equity Mate, you get a whole month.
Flood him.
You heard how Rudy did during the JFC, so you want to have your finger on that pulse, so go and sign up. But one thing that we particularly like about FN Arena is your coverage of reporting season. Mm. And we're keen to unpack some of that and, you know, learn from some of your insights there. But I guess if we do this sequentially, COVID hit a little bit before then, and we've seen a pretty unbelievable 6 months, both in the crash to March and then the recovery since. So I guess if we maybe start general, what have your biggest takeaways been during this COVID period?
It's probably good to point out here that in 2019, the two reporting seasons, the main reporting season are February and August, and we have companies in between, but people usually don't pay attention to those, or not too much. In 2019, we had probably the worst reporting season in Australia post-GFC. So to my conclusion, and maybe good to explain it to people as well, everyone always has a different view of how they look at the reporting season. And the price action in the reporting season doesn't always tell you the story. As a matter of fact, it usually doesn't. The way we look at the reporting season is you have expectations that are being put forward by the analysts, and then the company comes out, and then how does that relate to the expectations? Because one of the things I've learned by doing FN Arena, and this is the funny thing as well, you asked me earlier, why did I start up FN Arena? The funny thing is that I've since gone through my own journey in analyzing and researching the share market, and I'm using it with the same tools that I developed for investors on FN Arena. So when I want to analyze the reporting season, I use the same data that are available on the website, and that's, I mean, it's there for me and it's there for other people. So what I've learned over the years of doing this, the outcome from the reporting season is very much in how what the businesses decide to announce in that month, how that impacts on the forecasts put forward by analysts. So everyone's always critical about this, and oh, they're always wrong, and that's true. And always late, which is also true. And they're always biased, which is probably also true. But the matter of fact is, when they change their forecasts, that is the guideline for the share price. So it's not that difficult to understand or to predict which stocks are going to be higher in 3 months' time and which stocks are going to be lower. Right? ResMed, for example, disappointed in August, share price hasn't moved since. Yeah? And that's for that particular reason. Yeah? Other stocks have done better, and share price is more than likely is higher. Right? And that's on that simple metrics, that's how it works. And it doesn't mean that a company that comes out with a 250% growth, for example, has done better than expected. That's the element that investors have to catch up on. You also have to ask if a company grows by 250%, it might have missed expectation and the share price temporarily comes under pressure. Whether that's a bad thing in itself, right? Because if it keeps on growing in that phase, the share price will take care of itself. So that's the long and the short of it. Coming back to your question, we had the worst reporting seasons, February and in particular August in 2019, right? Whereby one of the predictions we made at FN Arena is if you're a typical dividend investor, start getting worried, be afraid. Yeah? And we could tell that because we were paying attention to what was happening in the reporting season. And we could tell that most businesses could hardly meet expectations, and they would really have to put everything they had to meet expectations. And you can sort of see the cracks starting to appearing. So, I mean, typically for Australian companies, the last thing they will do is cut dividends. Mm-hmm. Right? But it's not exactly. And I mean, they'll... But it started happening, basically. And you will find, for example, after August last year in 2019, the cyclicals, the energy companies, and the banks started cutting their dividends. I mean, and then, of course, you get the pandemic. I mean, and as you can also see from my presentation as well, Australia has been much heavier hit than internationally. And that is because of the combination of a very bad reporting seasons in 2019. So they're basically holding on with everything they have, and they can't really do it. And then, of course, more bad news means they just have to cut their dividends and much more, in a much more heavy-handed way than otherwise would have been the case. So you see, if you pay attention to reports, you see those things coming, I mean? And I remember when I gave presentations post-reporting season 2019, many people got really quiet when I said it, because they all thought like, yeah, but I own these stocks, yeah? I need my dividends, right? I need my franking credits. And I was saying, well, you're going to be hit, right? It's happening. So then obviously the pandemic hits and it's a big hit. But then August we just had is on those metrics, probably the best reporting season we had in Australia since the GFC, right? So you go from worst to bad, if not actually the other way around, you go from the worst to the best. And that is, again, because analysts who are analyzing those companies from the outside, they have no idea how much a company can do from the inside to lower their costs. And that was basically the big surprise. I mean, companies were able to lower their costs much further than analysts from the outside thought they could. And those were surprises in a way. I mean, profits are sometimes still down by half, but they were expected to be down by 60% or 70%. So they did actually perform better. The other element is that's also typical about the share market, and one of the reasons why I personally wasn't that worried about sell downs in August. Everyone was going, "Oh, we're going to get sell down because all looking going to look bad." No, because obviously by August we all realized that probably March, April was the bottom, and we're all looking forward to a recovery. Right? So we're all going to give a lot of companies the benefit of the recovery, basically, because we go, yeah, it's bad now, but they're going to do better. And I mean, as long as they're not called Sydney Airport or all the other ones were thinking like, oh, they actually do. And then, of course, the retailers were the big surprise in August, because we had no idea how much people were going to spend while locked up in their rooms. And it turns out a lot. Right? We're all buying new sofas. All of a sudden, those were the big surprises. I mean, the big question mark, of course, then becomes how swift, how gradual, how quickly is that recovery going to happen? And is that already priced in stocks? And the other thing was, is yes, those retailers and some of those technology stocks, they've really got all their demand propped up and coming in condensed form much quicker to them. But is that representative of what is actually going to stay with them? And those are the question marks that need to be, but they won't be answered until February next year. Right? And in the meantime, we do now get the out of season reporters, and I'm in particular interested in the likes of Zero, Technology One, Aristocrat Leisure, and the banks. I mean, let's see what the banks come up with, apart from potentially not paying out a dividend again.
Yeah, I've always thought that the next reporting season is actually going to be the one to watch out for, because there were too many unknowns going into this reporting season that, to your point, analysts probably couldn't understand how far companies can push themselves. The impact of stimulus was still being felt, further stimulus to come through. Now we've kind of had the Victoria thing as well. I think more light will be shone on companies that are really battling in the next reporting season.
It might actually that we have to wait until August next year together, because you see the government today again trying to do all, and it may well be that we only get a true picture by August next year. And of course, between now and then, the big question mark will be the vaccine. I mean, if we have one, it will make a tremendous change. If you don't have one, there's a tremendous change the other way.
Ride it while it lasts.
You mentioned there that August was actually a surprisingly good reporting season, and that it's not because companies were growing per se, but it's because they beat expectations. So let's throw some specific names out there. What were some of the companies that you think, you know, can be labeled the biggest winners? Maybe some that, you know, beat expectations by the most.
Let me put a sideline, because one thing I didn't mention earlier, and this is something that again came to the fore this reporting season. I think this is very, very important for investors who like to know what is actually happening in Australia. While this was the last one, while this was the best reporting season post GFC, it did not show up in the top 50. And paying close attention to the reporting seasons year in, year out, this has now become a theme, I would say, at least since 2016, if not 2015. So we are not talking about a one-off. We are talking about now years.
So for almost 5 years, the top 50 ASX companies have not beaten expectations.
They're basically pulling down the numbers.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So the numbers would look better if it wasn't for the top 50.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
And to make things worse, the top 50 also includes the likes of CSL, ResMed. Mm. I mean, these guys are actually amongst the very good performers.
Yeah. Right?
So it gets even worse for the ones who don't perform.
Do you want to name and shame the worst of the worst in the top 50?
Very, very easy to do. It's you have to think about the banks.
Yeah.
And you have to think about, in this case, not BHP and Rio, because for the Fortescue not, because Iron Ore has really kept them up. But Centaurs, Woodside, absolutely. I mean, dogs, I mean, can't catch a fly, right? Even if they wanted to. The ones who don't perform, Center Group, for example, Unibail, Rodamco Westfield, although the shopping centers, Australasia, big property firms, big mall owners, very, very questionable performances from the insurance companies, Suncorp, IAG, QBE. QBE is no longer top 50, but used to be there. So plenty, right? Plenty.
Property, banks, resources, that's what Australians love.
But in particular, the energy sector. Yeah. In particular, the energy sector. I mean, in Australia, the best performing sector by far over the past two decades has been healthcare.
Buy now, pay later.
No. That's only very recently. But over the longer term, it's healthcare absolutely shoots the lights out here, right? And that's because we have some of the from the really, really fantastic companies in Australia. The worst sector by far has been the energy sector. Yeah. By far, but absolutely by far. Right? At one stage, Santos seemed destined for $20. I mean, it went to $4.
Yeah.
Right? Woodside, people are always surprised. You know what the price at which Woodside peaked?
No.
$73. You know when that was? In May 2008. Right?
Wow.
Today, it's not even $20. I know. I mean, it has hardly had made a comeback until half of that share price.
Yeah. Mm.
So you can tell. I mean, and those are the big ones. I mean, and Origin Energy. I mean, it hasn't performed, and those are that's a lot of money went lost in those stocks.
I've been banging on a little bit recently about an equal weighted ASX 200 index ETF. And this seems to just be making my case even stronger that if a market cap weighted ETF has those big names, you know, more weighted, then that's not good news at all. We need an equal weighted one.
It's true, but it will all depend on whether the banks perform or not. And you will find that in Australia, the banks still are of big importance that the market weighted will be the equal weighted when the banks are in favor again, vice versa.
Yeah.
So you really have to see it in that correlation. That's why you always have to pay attention to the details when you see those things from the US. A lot of research from the US doesn't necessarily apply to Australia.
Yeah.
Like, for example, a very, very easy one where people often go wrong is the small caps in the US by far beat the large caps, all else being equal over a longer period of times. Mm. The average return in the US for small caps would be 15% a year on average, which is quite high, until you realize that what they call small caps in the US would be are just under the top 50 stocks like REA Group and Westmed and stuff. Mm. I mean, those are their small cap stocks.
Now. Yeah, there was 2 weeks where we did back-to-back. We interviewed an Australian small cap manager and then a US small cap manager. And the market cap they're talking about and the companies that they're talking about, completely different.
Yes, The sweet spot in Australia is also one of those little elements. The sweet spot in Australia is between, in the top 100, is between position number 51 and 100, So those 50, just outside the top 50, that's the sweet spot in Australia. And you realize those are the stocks that are the small caps in the US. So there is a correlation there. Yeah? And those are the stocks, if you think about it. REA comes out of that. Cochlear comes out of that. They used to be top 50. They just grow out of that gradually. But they come out of that top 50. Afterpay Touch comes out of that group, They don't stay there. They just grow out of it. Make sure that you don't pick them when they're on their way down.
We talked about some of the negative ones, but, you know, we want to be positive because there were some good performers.
So absolutely, absolutely.
Before we move on to the next section, what were one or two that really caught your eye that surprised on the upside?
Let me answer this in a general sense first. And this is also why I always say the narrative of the share market is wrong, Because I focus very much on quality. So I run a portfolio which has, at face value, a lot of stocks that people would not consider buying. So there are stocks trading on elevated PE ratios, which people go like, oh, but they're supposed to be expensive. Yeah? I always say they're not expensive at all. I mean, but for 5 years now, I see those stocks usually outperforming expectations in reporting season and being rewarded for it after reporting season. The only periods when that doesn't happen is when the gap between the top end of the market and the bottom end of the market has extended so much that there's a limit to how far the elastic band can go. And that happened in August 2019, and it happened in August 2018 as well, by the way. And then we got a lot more. It sort of happened this year as well, but in a little bit in a lesser sense. So we're basically talking about on the quality side, we're talking about companies like CSL. We're talking like an REA group, car sales, that type of company. And in the tech space, we're talking about companies like an Altium and Appen and a Zero, although Zero hasn't reported and Altium actually did disappoint. But Appen absolutely did not disappoint. But I named these names because with exception of now in August, the previous February or the previous August, they actually performed and continued performing. And that has been a trend which I have witnessed pretty much every year. I mean, I remember very well in February 2018, goes back way back, all those stocks got sort of like sold off a little bit before February because everyone thought like, oh, they are too expensive. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And then in February, they all rallied by 7, 8, 9, 10% on the day. Yeah? And I obviously, at that point in time, I was very happy with myself that I stayed loyal to the theme.
Yeah.
It also shows you that a price action doesn't always tell you the story. Yeah, it's a narrative that sometimes just permeates to the market and there's no other validity to it than everyone gets cautious. Yeah? So this year, what we've seen this year is that the companies that have performed really well in reporting season, and CSL was one of them, for example, they haven't necessarily, an REA group, and they haven't necessarily been rewarded for it because coming out of August, the market again concluded, oh, but the distance between the winners and the laggards is again the elastic band is, we have to narrow this. Mm. Yeah. So those stocks didn't really get and in the US, of course, we had the big technology companies all of a sudden needed to come down.
Yeah.
When share prices double in a matter of days, you know it's not normal. Yeah. Like let's just keep it to that.
Yeah.
And so September was very much a month in which the top of the Nasdaq had to come down. That weighs on stocks like, for example, an Appen here, although they performed really well, they did really well with their result. But market expectations probably a little bit bloated, plus Nasdaq sells off, so those stocks have to come off. Yeah. Again, to everyone's surprise, September hasn't really been kind to the cyclicals and the banks, yeah, because it's sort of like a mirror of 2018. Like first, it's the outperformers that have to pull back a little bit because it's a little bit too hot under the collar. But it develops into a weakness for the weaker ones. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So as a value investor, you get punished twice. That is the frustration of a lot of value investors, by the way.
So Rudy, we're keen to get stuck into this conversation of quality, but before we do, we were looking through a presentation that you put together and there was one thing that really caught our eye. You mentioned a grand debate between the fund managers Magellan and Platinum. Can you tell us what this grand debate is all about and where these two fund managers are butting heads?
I'm going to give a little bit of an insight in my age here. I still remember when everyone thought that Kerr Nielsen at Platinum Asset Management was like a demigod, the local Warren Buffett. Mm. Right? Today, nobody's paying attention to Platinum anymore.
Mm.
And that in itself shows us all that this time is different. It very much applies. I mean, things are constantly moving. And to go short on the theme, I always explain, and I thought that's one of the themes I put at the back of my presentation because I thought like I'll catch everyone's attention. And this is, if you want to know where things are going from here, well, there's basically two very polarized scenarios from here. Of course, we could potentially talk about this for days, but in the very short time frame that we have here, the reason why Magellan is one of the top fund managers in the world now and basically blows everyone out of the water in Australia is not because he's smarter than God. It's because he's on the right side of the pendulum in this particular point in time. And what do I mean by that? Is that 85% of the fund managers in Australia, not necessarily globally, but definitely in Australia, are value managers, right? Which basically means they buy into the narrative that as long as you buy them cheaply, you should be doing okay. They ignore a few things by doing that. And one of them is that strategy works as long as conditions are normal in the way that we knew them in the 80s, 90s. In the first 10 years of this millennium, they're no longer normal. And then all of a sudden that strategy doesn't work anymore. To my surprise, I always thought that smart people worked in finance, but I've now found out that many people are not that smart and they just stick by a narrative basically. And a lot of people actually got caught in that narrative and can't get out of it. So they can't change. And I do realize, and I mean, you guys are much younger than I am, but I do realize that one of the reasons why I can do what I'm doing is because I haven't been doing this for 40 years. And I can always imagine that if I had been doing this for 40 years, how difficult it had been for me to change with the changing times. Yeah? I wrote my first book in 2015, which I published there. And I thought at the time that I needed to be quick because I saw the times changing. Yeah? And you see it happening. And I thought, like, if I'm not going to be quick, because everyone in finance will jump on this. And to my surprise, nobody jumped on that, or very, very few did. Right? I thought it was very obvious to see that things were going to change, and that would have an impact on the share market and how investing works. In a very short summary, we push interest rates to all-time lows. We push as much money liquidity in the system as we can. We beat down inflation until there's no inflation left, and we have to basically be fighting deflation. So we're creating an incredible leverage in the system, and the system is itself very fragile, and we have much shorter cycles, and economic growth overall is at a, I wouldn't call it all-time low, but it's very low. If you combine all of that, that means that value investing all of a sudden has a very hard time. And why is that? Is because if you do research in the share market, and that's one of the things I've been emphasizing also, and I can't do that because I wasn't born here. I have no, I mean, I can say anything I like about Australian companies, and also because I'm independent as well. But I always tell people, listen, you know that the majority of companies that listed, they're not good companies, yeah? And in particular in Australia not. One of the characteristics that Australia had is that a lot of companies had a duopoly or a monopoly for a very long time. Yeah? That's a very good reason for a very subpar company to make good returns for shareholders. Yeah, they're basically protected. Mm-hmm. Yeah? But since those duopolies and oligopolies and monopolies have diluted, all of a sudden doesn't work anymore. Right? And you see those companies that are, used to be great Australians, I mean, AMP, Telstra, whatever, they have done nothing over the past two decades. So there's your value investing. Mediocre companies that have to adjust, that are being challenged, that and can't do it anymore, basically. Now, that's not the only story to this. A very important factor is inflation, bond yields, and interest rates. So what a platinum and the whole cohort of value investors are counting on is that all the stimulus we're putting now through economies at some stage are going to trigger inflation. It's going to push bond yields higher. It's going to force central bankers to raise interest rates instead of continuously lower them. And that, all else being equal, will favor those companies that haven't performed thus far. The insurance companies, the banks, the credit providers, the buildings companies, the resources companies, including the energy companies. So it's almost like a macro pendulum. But if it does swing, it will be incredibly savage. I've experienced the second half of 2016. It was savage, right? My portfolio went down by 20% virtually overnight. And the rest of the market went up by 20%. So the difference is really, really savage. Mm. I mean, and you're looking at your portfolio and you go like, yeah, right? And we've had that too. And it was savage at that time because I was convinced I was right and the market wasn't. And unfortunately, in the moment, there's nothing you can do about it. 12 months later, I was right, by the way, and the market wasn't. But if it happens again, so it can be very savage. So you have to be careful in extrapolating the technology revolutions that are happening, because they will be hit if that happens. Having said so, I don't think it's imminent, to be honest. And I know people are talking about it, but I don't think it's imminent. So the grand debate is the current situation where we find ourselves, low interest rates, low growth, low inflation, lots of stimulus, and basically no investments from companies, and you name it, is that going to persist for longer? And I basically think the answer is yes.
So you fall on the Hamish Douglas and Magellan side of the
pendulum. I'm on the Hamish Magellan. And we have to realize that is the reason why he's doing so well. I mean, he's not convinced, like the value investors, that this is temporary. Right? Mm. And if you think about it, just to add to that argument, once you build so much debt in the system and you make money as cheap as it is, people are going to use it. I mean, like, put 12 kids in a room and put some sugary stuff in the middle. I mean, no matter how well they're educated they are or behaved, ultimately that the candy will get eaten, yeah? Mm. And that is the same with cheap money and lots of debt. Yeah?
Yeah.
On some calculations, percentage of zombie companies around the world is approaching 17%. Yeah? That means it's a little bit more than one in five. Right? Zombie companies are companies who do not generate enough cash to pay the interest on their loan for 3 years. Yeah, it's absolutely scary stuff.
It is, yeah.
But it makes you wonder, how do we ever get out of this funk?
Yeah, it really does. And I feel that's probably a whole other podcast episode. Let's go from zombie companies to the opposite end of the market and talk about quality, because, you know, that really is the name of this game. That's how, you know, the Warren Buffetts and all of that of the world have made their money. They've found a few very small number of companies and held them for a very long time. You, in an email that you wrote to your FN Arena subscribers, wrote that a study that was done found that of all the share market gains since 1926, it can be explained by as little as 4% of the best performing stocks driving those gains. And, you know, people living through 2020 can think about a few companies driving share market returns, the Apples, Amazons, Alphabets of the world. If such a small number of companies drive so much of the returns, then the question really becomes, how do you find those companies? And I guess that ties into what we were talking about earlier. How do you think about quality, and what is quality to you?
Yeah. So I started defining quality as companies that's why I call them all-weather stocks. I mean, companies that can perform for shareholders irrespectively of whether interest rates go up or down, or the currency go up and down. And I mean, it's not to say that those companies sometimes can't have a bad year, or I mean, within perspective, I mean, but they will perform, I mean, over time. My definition is that a good company, unless there's like a meteor coming to Earth or whatever, doesn't report like 50% drop in profits or anything along those lines. I mean, like that's not quality. I mean. And if you start looking into the deeper elements of that, then you will find there's not too many companies around that can actually say that. I mean, I think from memory, my selection of all-weather stocks in Australia, I don't think it has ever been more than 20. And even 20 is probably a little bit of a stretch. We're not talking about a lot of companies. What I think is equally important here is that those companies never trade on cheap multiples.
Okay.
Right. So you won't find them on a multiple of 12, yeah?
Yeah.
And it's almost by definition. If they are on that multiple, it means that A, they're not a good company. B, they're not discovered yet, which is very unlikely, yeah? And this is one of the reasons why I started challenging the narrative that is in the share market all the time, yeah? See, in my research, what didn't make sense to me is that, we're talking years and years, years ago, CSL was always trading on a multiple, let's call it 30, 28, whatever, yeah? And then people would say like, ooh, can't buy that, right? And then other people would call it defensive. And I thought like, how can it be defensive when it's on a high PE? And then a year later, the share price was up 30% or so. And you go like, okay, one off, right? But a year later, it was again up 20%, yeah? You go like, well, something doesn't match up here, right? Because the stocks that are supposedly cheap, they just became cheaper, or they have like one good year or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the stocks that you possibly can't buy, and they look like really good companies to me, then they perform. And they are the ones who continuously make their inroads in the index as well. CSL, I predicted years in advance, is going to be the number one stock in the index. Mm-hmm. You see it happening. You see it coming. Yeah? And to my surprise, nobody owned it. Yeah? If you go back 4 or 5 years, nobody owned it. Yeah. Everyone would go like, nah, can't buy that one. It's not high PE. You go like, and? What's your problem?
Well, even this reporting season, the articles written about CSL were like, it's an unbelievable company. It's got such a long pipeline. Its investments in R&D are paying off, but it's too expensive to buy. And it's like, well, yeah, if that's the only negative thing you can say about it.
Mm. Exactly. Yeah. But to give you an example of what very much adds to the quality benchmark, because by analyzing CSL, I learned a lot from what actually makes a good company. Because I think CSL is probably the number one company we have in Australia. I mean, on many accounts. I mean, and very, very easy measure I've developed over the years is there's this narrative in Australia that Australian companies can't go overseas. I mean, they suck at it, basically. Mm. I say, well, in general terms, that's correct, because most Australian companies are not good companies. Eh? So if they go overseas, they just get put back in their box. But the good companies you have, they succeed overseas, yeah? And you shouldn't look further. I mean, the CSLs, the Cochlears, the ResMeds, they are number one in their market globally. Right? They have competition in many markets every single day. Right? The fact that they can keep their position there, right? And these guys are market leaders in their field, gives you already an indication how much is the quality stock. Yeah? What Australian investors also underestimate is that those companies, like CSL, for example, spends close to $1 billion every year on research and development. $1 billion. Yeah. They could, if they decided, they could pay out in dividends.
Yeah.
Yeah? But they don't do that. And every year they spend that about between 10 and 12% of their revenue on research and development. If you read international studies, right, that's what those companies do. Yeah, the ones who stay on top for longer, yeah, and sometimes for decades. There's no guarantees because you still have to generate a return and you still have to create new products and have success and stuff like that. But that's the step that you can't skip. Yeah, yeah? And I mentioned AMP and Telstra earlier. These guys didn't spend anything near that, and they just paid out to shareholders and just kept hobbling along as long as they could. And ultimately, the share price deflates, right, instead of going up. Right? And I think the fact that you make consistent investments year in, year out, and after a while, obviously, you become experts in what you do with that money, and you start generating a product portfolio that continuously innovates and continuously innovates again and again. Because at the end of the day, it's about finding growth. I mean, growth is not growth, you can have it, but the good business leader looks forward and thinks like, well, this growth can't be taken for granted. You have to find additional growth. And if you look at the history, for example, of a CSL, I mean, the fact that at one stage they added the Seqirus business, which is the virus, another growth engine to already a fantastic business. Yeah, so it's about finding growth and keeping that pendulum going. I mean, because there are examples of companies that once upon a time were leaders and lost their way. Right, it's possible. Right, yeah. But what I've learned is that because valuation is something that's very very short term focused, you happily pay over for a quality business, because you can trust if it's a quality business, the share price will take care of itself.
Yeah. They say the same thing about Amazon, you know, like all through its growth story, it traded at a PE of call it 60, and so many people were short it just because of its valuation, but it just kept growing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and it's nothing as easy, and that's what they do, of course, nothing as easy as going short a stock that looks bloated and then obviously you lose your pants.
Yeah. Yeah.
Afterpay.
Goodman Group.
Hey, well, you know, if a sign of a good Australian company is it goes overseas and it succeeds, well, Afterpay is overseas. Yet to be seen if it's going to succeed, but you might be right, Bryce.
Yes. So, Rudy, to close out the convo on quality, you have mentioned a couple of indicators as to what a poor quality company looks like, which I think is equally as important as understanding what a good quality company looks like. Are there any more considerations or red flags that we should think about when, I guess, trying to avoid these poorer quality companies?
I recently read a book which is Good to Great, which is a book which was published in 2001, mind you. And to my astonishment, there were quite a few things that came to the fore from that book where you go like, it's so easy to recognize those things, yeah? Because that book tells the readers the difference between a great company and a mediocre company is they have access to the same information. They just respond to it differently. Mm. And he had, in the book, there are clear examples of businesses that basically refuse to change, because one of them uses as an example, you can't argue with 80 years of success. Yeah? So they kept doing what worked for 80 years, and then 10 years later they were out of business. Yeah? It's come to the fact that you can recognize from the onset how is a business responding to challenges. And if they just bunker in and hope for the best, that's not a great strategy. Yeah? So you already know. I don't want to piss down on Telstra all the time, but but I've followed Telstra for 2 decades now. These guys have bought businesses in the US, yeah? And 2-3 years later, you hear nothing about them anymore. They've closed down, they've sold it, whatever. So obviously nothing works, yeah? if you try to distance yourself from the fact that you own the shares and you're dependent on their payout twice a year, you should be able to just sit from your sofa at home and think like, well, that's not a good business. Yeah, when you buy stuff, it should add to growth, not disappear in the ether and nobody talks about it anymore. That's just one of the things. The other thing, which was came very much to the fore in the US, and it's just very much an idea there, is the it's whether you have a so-called very famous CEO, who a glamour CEO, who basically takes all the attention to himself and acts for his own bank account, not necessarily in shareholders' interest. Australia has many companies, I believe, that are being run for the major shareholder, not so much for the minority shareholders. Harvey Norman, Crown, there's a few other ones, I mean, News Corp. Huh? see, I never go anywhere near those companies, yeah, because I know I'll be third-rank citizen, I mean, even with my small stake in particular. I mean, again, it is also when you have the choice between am I going to invest in the business or am I going to please the shareholders in the short term and just pay out a little bit more? Again, one of the conclusions of August this year was Australian companies choose for the second option. Yeah? Well, arguably, they should go for the first because a lot of businesses are challenged. Yeah? If you don't keep the cash to yourself and you can explain to shareholders that, guys, this is a crisis, we need the money, we need to invest, we need to reinvent the business, then you will never be able to, but it also means you will always be a mediocre business. It will never be great. And I think those are things that everyone from his sofa can analyze and can see.
Mm. I know we're running short on time, but my ears picked up when you said those three businesses, Harvey Norman, Crown and News Corp, who all have their owners and their founders as major shareholders. And that seems to cut against, you know, what you often hear in the smaller end of the market where businesses that have owner operators that are large shareholders and are running the company is often a good sign. Where on the growth scale does it change from being a really good sign to being a really bad sign?
I'm not so sure whether it's a growth scale. I think it's the way, and that's why you have to watch how those businesses are being managed, yeah? Good to great, for example, we spoke about investments earlier. Also says that when businesses steer away from their core competency, that's a warning sign. That's not good. Yeah, Harvey Norman, for example, they've used shareholders' money to buy into dairies and other fancy stuff. Yeah, that's not stuff that should be. If he wants to do that, he just should do it with his own money. Yeah, not with the shareholders' money. See, yeah. Those are warning signals. Yeah? And you so often see it with smaller companies as well. If a board is only there to just to be filled up with yes men and always say yes to the guy who runs the business, that's not a great board. Yeah. Yeah? That's also, again, that's a warning signal again. And some of those businesses have that type of boards. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's now coming to the fore again with Crown, for example. I mean, that everyone is just bowing to the major shareholder. I mean, that's not a great business. Yeah. Like the great businesses, I'm pretty certain they have, I mean, toe-to-toe fights over a certain investment that needs to be made or not. Yeah. Right? And that's what makes a great business. The other ones don't.
Yeah. Mm. So, Rudy, we've taken over an hour of your time and we want to say thank you for coming on. I think it's been a great conversation and I'm sure if Bryce didn't have the stopwatch over here, we could have gone down a number of rabbit holes. So I think we'll have to get you on another time and we can go down some of those rabbit holes in due course. But before we do like to finish with the same final three questions. So we'll get stuck into them. But just a reminder for people, fnarena.com, tell Rudy that Equity Mate sent you, you get a month free. How could you not after this conversation? The final three questions. The first one we like to ask, do you have any must-read books?
Oh, yes, I have all lists. I'll leave the list for you guys here. Nice. You can use them after the program.
But yeah, we'll include them in our show notes for this episode as well.
Exactly. If I just go very quickly to them. For typical investment books, I think everyone should start with A Random Walk Down Wall Street by Burton Malkiel. Great book. It also explains to you that a technical analyst doesn't work. And we go a little bit more left field now. Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, Edwin Lefebvre. Very classic. The more you know about the share market yourself, the more you appreciate the book. It's one of those books that you can reread through your career and every time get more out of it. Then there is Confusion de Confusiones, which is one of the first books about the Amsterdam Stock Exchange, which was the first one in the world. That one you can probably just download. You can probably find on the internet and download it. There's no copyrights on that one anymore. And what I found interesting by that one is how much it resembles today. I mean, people are people. I mean, we go short, we spread rumors, we do all the stupid things. Then there was an Australian author, Michael Kemp, who wrote a book, Uncommon Sense, which from 2 years ago. He basically goes hundreds of pages explaining why things don't work, including PE ratios and all of that. Then there is James Montier, who wrote The Little Book of Behavioral Investing. Very good to figure out why we make the same mistakes we always make, because we're human. An American book, I picked one, Dividends Still Don't Lie by Kelly Wright. It's particularly good because it's a U.S. book, and it emphasizes the importance of dividends from a U.S. perspective, and they pay a lot less than we do here. And then finally, and I'm a little bit biased here because I do know Danielle Ecuyer, and I know she was in this program for a while. And Shareplicity is definitely something that investors can, for the simple reason that it doesn't do what a lot of people do and try to go like you have to analyze the balance sheet and all of that. You don't. And then there's a few books that I think you shouldn't stick to just investment books. So I would add Good to Great by Jim Collins, just to show you what a good business looks like. Then there is The Trick by William Leith, essentially a journalist who interviews successful people and tries to find out what made them successful. There is Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. Absolutely, I found it actually fascinating. Then there is The Ascent of Money by Niall Ferguson. And finally, Liar Spoker by Michael Lewis, if you want to know what the 80s look like.
And there's
many other books from Michael Lewis, by the way. And I'll happily leave the list here.
Nice one. So we've got that list. We'll include that in the show notes so people can check them all out. The second question we like to ask, now, aside from FN Arena, what's your go-to source for investing and financial information?
Oh, that's a good one. See, I'm privileged here. I have access to a hell of a lot research, like global research, and read as much as I can. And I've particularly in the first 10 years in Australia, I read as much as I could. I also thought I need to, because if I'm the editor and if I'm telling people what's going to happen, I need to know a few things. And so I basically read everything I can get my hands on, from what is actually happening in credit markets, to what liquidity does, to where is inflation gone, how do you value a modern day technology company, and all of that. I don't think there's any services in particular out there that give me that information. Mm-hmm. What I tend to do, I do subscribe to a few services every once in a while that give me a completely different perspective, do completely different things than I'm looking at. And that's just sometimes to give me a different perspective on things. But in general terms, I can't get past FN Arena.
Fair enough. Final question. If you think back to your early days when you were earning 15% interest in the bank, what advice would you have for your younger self?
Invest in yourself. Don't give up just because things are not working out in the moment. If you keep on investing in yourself, you will get there where you want to come, or where you want to be. And I think that's essentially what has happened in my life. I mean, I would have never imagined when I was 9 that I would end up in a studio with two guys in Sydney 3 decades later, talking about the Australian share market.
Yeah.
See, the funny thing is, when I arrived in Australia in the year 2000, I knew 5 Australian companies, 5. And 10 years later, I was telling people why they were doing things wrong in investing in the share market. And that's how quickly you can make your evolution, by basically investing in yourself. And in my case, spending an inordinate amount of time in reading and reading up on things and challenging the narrative as well. Not just accepting that, because it's cheap, it's going to be a good investment. Turns out, often it's not.
Well, Rudy, it's been awesome having you on the show. You are on Twitter as well, so I suggest that our audience follow you for some up-to-date insight from the work that you're doing, but also head across to fnarena.com for more in-depth analysis of some of the stuff that we've been talking about today. So really appreciate you coming on, and I'm sure it won't be the last time. Alex got a lot of things to unpack. But again, thanks for your time. Much appreciated.
My pleasure, guys.
Thanks, Rudy.
Thanks for listening to Equity Mates Investing Podcast, a production of Equity Mates Media. Please remember that everything you hear in Equity Mates Investing Podcast is general advice only. The content has been prepared without knowing your personal objectives, specific financial circumstances, or goals. The host of Equity Mates Investing Podcast may maintain positions in the companies discussed. Before considering any investment, please read the product disclosure statement and consider speaking to a licensed financial professional.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.